Hello to our listeners, and welcome to the Women Governance Trailblazers podcast, where we listen to the journeys of trailblazing women in the corporate governance field, their passions, struggles, and commitment to improving how companies and boards function. My name is Liz Dunshee, and my co-host is Courtney Camlett.
Hi, everyone.
Courtney and I are both passionate about governance, and we want to spotlight some of the trailblazing women who share that passion. We love connecting with guests from different paths and industries to hear their perspectives on what surprised them in their career and where they think the field of corporate governance is heading. And for this episode, we are delighted to be talking with Maeve O'Connor. Maeve is co-chair of Debevoise's securities litigation practice and chair of its insurance litigation practice. And Maeve has also served on the firm's management committee and has extensive experience defending complex securities cases, including fiduciary duties and M&A disputes, and advising public companies and their boards in high-stakes litigation and governance matters. Maeve is recognized nationally for her work, and she's a leading voice at the intersection of securities and governance. So thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here. And I will say I really enjoy your podcast very much. I've listened to some of the episodes and they're super interesting and
Thank
thoughtful.
you. Thank you.
Awesome. We love to hear that.
And Maeve, we're really interested in learning more about your career path. What drew you to securities litigation, and what do you find most rewarding about what you do?
So it's funny, some people start their career with a sense that they're going in a certain direction and they know what it is, and other people more fall into it. I just found over the years of practice that I was really enjoying both 10b5 stock drop type cases and fiduciary duty litigation, claims against boards of directors, often M&A disputes. These are the things that we consider in the bucket of securities litigation. And I love them both. I feel very lucky to practice in this area. I think what drew me to them is that they combine really hard, high stakes, complicated issues that require kind of sophisticated analysis and thinking with a really great human element of advising at a senior level on a high stakes matter. If it's a stock drop case, how are we going to land this plane at an optimal time and place? And what are the surrounding considerations that may exist? Because sometimes securities cases have related regulatory and other matters alongside. In a fiduciary duty matter, you're advising the board sometimes on a high stakes transaction. And so they involve building relationships of trust and drawing on what a former mentor of mine used to call experience-based judgment. Which of course grows with time. Your decades of practice, the base of experience that informs your judgment grows, and the job just kind of gets better every year.
Well, it's great that you found your passion, and it sounds like you really like working in the complex, but then you can also talk to people sort of at a base level and explain everything, which is great.
Yeah, I think that's part of what I really enjoy about it, honestly, is taking the complex and making it digestible. That's what you have to do in speaking to the court, obviously, on a very complicated matter. You have to break it down in a way where, it can be consumed. And so I really do enjoy that aspect of a super complicated matter and streaming it down to a truthful and forceful narrative that kind of explains what happened and helps resolve it.
That's a real art form.
I think so. Yeah, I think
Yeah.
so. I think it's someone once asked me, what's your superpower? And I said, it's I can take a writing of any length and make it shorter.
Well, that's an important superpower to have in today's day and age, because yes, they're getting lengthy out there. And I imagine another important skill is kind of being able to predict where enforcement priorities might lie. And so we're interested in what you think about the current environment and whether you expect this deregulatory initiative that we're seeing to have a long-term impact on governance practices and litigation trends, and how you think boards can work their way through this with balancing risks and opportunities.
We're obviously at a really interesting time of very rapid change at the federal level. And I think the key question is whether it's durable change, because the statute of limitations on most types of enforcement actions is longer than the 3 years that remain in this particular administration. And we don't know what the next administration will be and what its enforcement priorities will be. So we've obviously been over time through periods of regulation and deregulation. And when one regulator steps back, others often step forward. We're seeing that now with the states. And I think as well as kind of, you know, internationally, regulators coming forward. So I think a good example is the crypto space. The DOJ cryptocurrency enforcement group has been disbanded, but you're seeing states step up their enforcement efforts. So, you know, it's I think sort of the smart advice is probably stay the course, because, you know, you don't want to let up on your compliance efforts, because you don't really know what's coming. And generally, it's a good idea to maintain compliance. And especially a board is going to want to be doing a excellent job in its oversight of the company and management of risks. And so, you know, you'd want to kind of approach that with caution. Don't dial back your compliance efforts. And of course, if a company gets an enforcement matter right now, you'd still advise them to cooperate and take the same steps that you would take in any setting. There may be a difference in outcomes. We have seen, I had a client with a 5-year enforcement action that just got a letter kind of saying, all right, never mind. And so you're seeing some declinations. I think you're seeing maybe some lesser fines and some shifts in enforcement, but you know, you still don't, not enough to feel like this is a time when you can start, you know, acting differently, because you don't know what's coming, and the federal government is just one piece of the regulatory puzzle for companies.
I'll say, wearing both a governance and compliance hat at a public company, your don't dial back the compliance efforts is huge, because that is something that companies do struggle with, and even boards question, you know, should we do more or less?
Yeah, absolutely. And I understand why, because some of that stuff is costly and feels burdensome to the company, right? But I think you have to realize that there's kind of a long-term picture here, and you can prematurely let up on compliance in a certain area, and then, you know, have there be a change in enforcement priorities in the government, or have a state enter a new realm of a different type of enforcement than they had been doing, and suddenly you're caught. And I don't think any board wants that. So I think that is the best advice right now for boards. And maybe over time, there'll be some shifts in focus, as always happens, right? Because boards are always looking at, are we managing risks in the best way? Are we, you know, do we have the right focus and the right prioritization of resources on risk management?
Yeah. And as you mentioned, there are a lot of different pieces. Private litigation is part of that too. What investors might be looking for, like there's been commentary this week on maybe doing away with 10Qs, but I don't know that companies should really rush into jettisoning their you know, earnings releases and things like that, because there are probably other drivers behind.
Exactly. I think there are other factors that are going to keep the 10Q alive for a little while longer is my sense.
Yeah. Perhaps.
Are you seeing any other emerging trends in securities litigation that those of us on the advisory side should be aware of? And what are some common things that boards or special committees and their counsel wish they could change in hindsight when it comes to painting a favorable picture in litigation?
Oh, so two pieces to the question. I'm going to make a note to myself on change in hindsight, because that's one I want to circle back to. On enforcement, on emerging trends that I think are important in the federal security space, there's been an increasing focus on, by the plaintiffs bar, on risk disclosures in SEC filings, and in particular on the question of whether a risk disclosure may be misleading if it describes in hypothetical terms a risk that arguably already came to pass. And of course, there's arguments in the gray areas all around that. And so, to borrow from a case that was in the Ninth Circuit against Meta, related to the Cambridge Analytica issue, where user data got used in connection with, I think, the presidential election. You know, if a company says there's a risk that disclosure of user data could adversely impact the company. Is that misleading? Do you need to say, and by the way, some user data has already been disclosed? What exactly is the company required to do in that space? And the Supreme Court took up the Facebook case, actually, I guess a year ago or so, but then ended up hearing argument and then dismissing it, saying cert was improvidently granted. So there is kind of gray area in those cases, and there's airspace between the different cases out there on this question of risk disclosures. It's obviously something that boards need to be scrutinizing, right? What the language of those risk disclosures against events that are known to have happened, just because that's a focus of the plaintiff's bar. There's also an increasing number of AI related claims, and the federal securities laws obviously are a disclosure based regime. So the focus is, did you overhype your AI capabilities and what the return was going to be on the investment that you're making there? So again, boards need to be looking at those disclosures, but that bumps up against another, I think, quite interesting issue that's impacting some or even many boards now. And maybe to just take one step back, in the cyberspace, it took a number of years for boards to get up to speed on how is it that we're monitoring cyber risk, what are we doing? And now that there's companies have a chief information security officer, CISO, and that person usually has right dotted line reporting to the audit committee. So the board has direct access to that person who is accountable for the security of the company's networks, who has credibility and expertise in that area. In the AI space, I think companies are making significant investments. It may not always be clear to the board. How are we measuring whether we're getting a return on this investment, and are there downside risks? And who's our subject matter expert on the downside risks? Who's our one person? Who's our CISO on kind of AI developments in the company? And I do think that we're going to see sort of pushes in some companies by some boards to have a little bit more direct access to a single accountable person. And it's challenging, right? Because AI, it's new, it's evolving. And to be that one person, you probably need expertise in 20 areas, right? So I don't exactly know who that person is, but right now you've got, say, you might be a board who has, excellent management, you have a ton of trust in, they're really pushing AI initiatives, there's a big investment, but, is the company making an equal investment in looking at the downside potential risks of that AI investment, if there are any, and who has the expertise to see around the corners of that? It may be covered, it may not be covered. And I think that like a CISO provides some clarity and accountability and reporting to a board in a very direct way. And I think that in the AI space, we may over time start seeing a move towards something similar for boards.
I think you're going to start seeing more chief information officers that play a role separate from the CISO, but also in conjunction with, would be my guess. And also, it's very evident to me that the boards are using AI to prepare for meetings, to draft things. So there is a training element that's definitely needed there.
Yes, that's a great point as well. Yeah, I mean it's funny, it's evolving very quickly, and I think that there's a lot of excitement obviously around it, and also some level of anxiety around it and maybe uncertainty. So if you're a board and a company is using AI in some core part of the business, you might feel like, oh, okay, great, but do we fully understand this? Is it being communicated? Maybe somebody does. Is it being communicated well enough to me? I think you're right, Courtney. I think it's an interesting point that may be exactly who kind of starts having to step up and play that role as to the potential downside risks of AI and kind of return on investment and how it's being used.
Say on a separate note, going back to your risk factors discussion, I'm just waiting for someone in a private closed instance of a chat GPT to take the risk factors and say, examine our risk factors that are probably 14 pages compared to the company and streamline it for someone who has a second grade reading level of understanding and see what it comes up with.
That would be very interesting. Very, very interesting. And, look, it might be a useful process, honestly, for a company to be thinking about, is this plain language? What are we communicating? Are we communicating it well enough? Is that what we meant? I mean, I think these do get pored over, but, I've been litigating this issue in a case. I have an appellate argument later next month, and it can come down to the placement of the comma in the risk factor. What is it that you're saying exactly is the risk? Is the risk the potential harm to the company from the thing, or is the risk the thing happening, comma, which could harm the company? And what does it mean? So I think that could actually be helpful, honestly.
Okay, well, that makes me feel a little bit better by for sometimes agonizing over the placement of commas, because I think disclosure lawyers get a bad rap sometimes, but you heard it here. Makes a
Listen, those
difference.
commas matter. They matter. Courtney had asked also, there was a second part of the question, which was
Yes.
kind of what do we see companies wishing they could change in the aftermath? And just a couple things to touch on there, because sometimes it's like so specific to the matter that it's hard to, but I think one is, what was the record? What do your minutes look like? Do your minutes have enough information, right? Because there's sort of two schools of thought on board minutes. One is, simple and summary, and one is more detailed. And, different companies can, land in different places. Reasonable minds can land in different places. I will say, from a litigation perspective, a very summary set of minutes does not help you build your record, and you have no way to refresh the recollection of a director from based on non-privileged materials, because the minutes don't show what you know happened. And so that can be hard. And often people do feel like, gee, I wish these minutes had shown a little bit more what we were thinking at the time. So that's kind of one piece. And another is, sometimes for a board facing reporting from the company on various things, it can be hard to identify when is something that you hear in the nature of a red flag. Sometimes it just feels like an incremental additional thing. So when do you start to feel, and maybe it's an area that boards really need legal advice on, but failing to have done enough digging when something that in retrospect is identified as a red flag came to the board is another, I think, fairly common issue that we see in litigation that I think people wish, gee, if only. And some of it is that is the, the retrospective hindsight spin that a skilled plaintiff's lawyer can put on events that maybe really at the time really weren't a red flag, but sometimes there is a real thing that maybe didn't quite get the attention it needed in the time.
Yeah, and with such an abundance of information that boards receive, it can be sometimes hard for them in real time to figure out what are the things that are important and what are the things that are just noise, which kind of goes
Right.
back to your point earlier about experienced judgment and also supports the notion that corporate lawyers who are preparing the minutes and working with the board should probably also involve litigators, at least from time to time, to get that kind of like hindsight perspective from what you have seen gone wrong in other situations.
Yeah, I think that's right. And there are times when minutes can be written in a way where much of it would be privileged. And that's not necessarily helpful. And sometimes you could have written it in a way where it wouldn't be mostly privileged, and that would be more helpful. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic. I do think it's helpful to have, especially in a situation that could raise concerns later, or in the negotiation of a transaction where litigation is almost a certainty. I think it is useful to have litigation eyes on it.
So shifting gears a little bit, what changes are you seeing as a result of the 2025 amendments to the Delaware General Corporation Law, which has been, much discussed, and all of the related issues to that with DEXA and everything? Anything new from that?
Yeah, I mean, that has been such a it's been a dramatic year in the state of Delaware. I actually was involved in litigating the match case, which
Oh,
is part of
wow.
what the legislature reversed. And we were just in court yesterday on the final approval of that settlement. And the vice chancellor spoke about kind of the she referred to it as the annus horribilis for the state of Delaware from the time the Supreme Court decision in match came down. Through the next year, and the amendments, and just the kind of the challenges that presented. It was a very interesting time for those of us who litigate in Delaware. I would say a couple of things. In terms of changes, the statute's still very new, and so We're certainly advising boards differently in transactional settings because, you know, you don't need the same committee structure in all circumstances. The definition of what and who is a controller is different, and control group. So you have these kind of guidelines to look at that are different. I think that practitioners are still in the phase of, you know, let me read it again, right? Because, you know, the words haven't really yet been interpreted by courts. And I'm sure that there will be litigation, you know, around what does this mean and what does that mean? And are these two points inconsistent? But the most obvious ways that it's different is in the advising on a transaction and the type of structure that you want to put in place and on how you negotiate it. And of course, 220 books and records demands, we just got one in the other day. They are much narrower. I haven't yet seen, there's an ability for a member of the Court of Chancery to order broader production, but I haven't yet seen that happen. So it's a lot of kind of wait and see. And I think there will be many years ahead of litigation that clarifies aspects of the statute and what it means. On, you know, Dexit and those related issues, it's hard to say exactly how big a phenomenon it will be. I think there was an initial wave of controlled companies, mainly some very high profile leaving, and then that kind of died to a trickle. The main difference may be that now when a company is being incorporated, there's a question. And there didn't used to be a question. It used to just be, okay, and it's going to be Delaware. And now, you know, sometimes there's a blank. What's the state going to be? And that's a discussion point, which is interesting. You know, and obviously Texas, Nevada, and other states are, you know, creating business courts or in the process of that and trying to, you know, eliminate jury trials to match Delaware. And in some instances, even saying that a court can't look to Delaware law if that law would in any way be inconsistent with the state's law. So it's interesting. I will say this, Delaware law has been around for a very long time. It is super well developed, and that gives much greater predictability. I think people don't yet know how they'll feel about the courts in Texas and Nevada, or how different outcomes will be. And even our current very divided Supreme Court is unanimous almost 50% of the time. So there may be lots of areas where it's very similar. And, you know, so I think it remains to be seen. Right now, I would expect Delaware to still be very influential for for a very long time.
Yeah, we're seeing states definitely ramping up their business courts. Even in North Carolina, they're doing the same thing because they want to have a model more like Delaware.
Yeah, in fact, I was before a judge in the North Carolina Business Court a year or so ago, and he was great, very smart. You know, it was an impressive court, and I think it's great if there's more state courts where, as a person who primarily litigates on the defense side, you feel you're going to get a sophisticated hearing. You know, it's I always say about Delaware, you know, you may lose, but it's not going to be because you weren't understood, and that's actually really important, right? And I think it's going to be interesting to see how litigation goes in these other courts and how people feel about those outcomes.
Based on your extensive experience advising clients, as well as your time leading DEPA Voice's securities litigation and insurance litigation practices and serving on the firm's management committee, what advice would you give to early career lawyers, especially women who aspire to be part of the next generation of governance trailblazers?
So that is a great question. I guess I would say a few things. First, I would say put in the time to develop the expertise, because I think there can be a sense when you're a young lawyer that more senior lawyers just kind of know things, and maybe they don't realize that you have to continue learning all the time. So when a Delaware decision comes out, I read it. And, you know, when a new securities litigation decision comes out, I read it. And you have to put in that time to get up those learning curves so that you get to the place where you can advise senior lawyers or a board, you know, even in response to an unanticipated question, because you've been learning for 10, 20, 30 years and have continued to add to that base of experience that your judgment is drawn on. So, you know, that continual learning, I would say, is really a privilege and a joy of the job, that it's like a lifelong learning curve in a sense. And you hope every year to be a better lawyer than the year before, but you have to, in addition to the work that is before you, put in the elbow grease to learn. Second thing I would say is show up. Be present, come physically into the office, make relationships, show up at the social event, show up at the training, take advantage of the opportunities that are presented. And that's, I think, really incredibly important. Just being a presence in the office, meeting people, that's how you build these relationships. And I would say, look around for people who have a career that you admire and get to know them and see if you can work with them and ask kind of how they got there and, you know, what their advice would be for you.
That's all such great advice. And active learning is so important, as is sort of getting outside your comfort zone. And even if you're not an extrovert, socializing and meeting with people.
Yeah, I think it really matters. And obviously mentorship matters as well, but I think that, and no way I'm trying to downplay mentorship, but I think that the best mentoring relationships really grow if you're there.
Thanks so much, Maeve. This has been an amazing conversation. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed chatting with both of you, and it's been just a pleasure to be here.
For those who are listening, we want to thank you as well. Please subscribe to Women Governance Trailblazers on whatever platform you use for podcasts, and we would love if you would rate us while you're there. In addition, if you know a Women Governance Trailblazer who you think would be a great guest on this show, please feel free to ping Liz or me either by LinkedIn or email.